Welcome to Life Beyond Death. Welcome. My name is Ted Peters. I teach at the Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California. And our topic for today is there life beyond death? And I would like to take a look at a variety of points of view on this particular subject. One way to get at important questions is to compare what the options are. And that leads then to a second motive to see what it is that Christians think, how the Christian point of view compares and contrasts with other points of view, and what kind of stake we have in this. I think the subject matter is a difficult one to begin with, and various points of view kind of blur over into one another. But my experience in taking a look at it is that what Christians have to say is pretty audacious, and relative to other points of view, perhaps even absurd. But that's where we are. So I thought I would take a look at some varieties of opinions, judgments that currently exist, options, so to speak, and then take a look at what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, where we probably have more detail there than anywhere else in Scripture about what it is that we're talking about. So you've got an outline there in front of you, and I'm sure that I will not get all the way through the outline. I guess when we die, we always have some unfinished business. Well, this morning we may end up with some unfinished business too. Note I have listed some alternative theories here. I think we're probably going to be familiar with all, or at least most of these. And I'd like to do my best to finish sufficiently early so that we'll have time for conversation and interchange. And if it looks like my time is getting used up, maybe somebody can remind me. Actually, my teaching assistant, Mary Lowe, is here. Mary, she could do here what she does back in Berkeley. Tell me if I'm running late, Mary. All right, let's take a look at the first point of view, naturalism. Naturalism is the view that when you're dead, you're dead. And I think in our modern Western society and culture, wherein we're basically materialist in the way that we look at things, when you're dead, you're dead is virtually the default position, and certainly the one that that seems the most consistent with the way we understand reality scientifically. Naturalism is a philosophy says that nature is all there is, that the natural world is the whole of reality, it's self-existent, it's self-explanatory, it's self-operating. Basically, you don't need anything beyond it. You don't need a God beyond it, and you certainly can't expect anything that's finite and dies to go beyond it. Naturalism would be the philosophy of the movie Contact, if you would like to see that in all of its glory. The great atheists of the 20th century are usually naturalists. One of the most outspoken was a guy named Bertrand Russell, a philosopher and mathematician in Great Britain for the first half of the 20th century. In 1907, he wrote an essay called A Free Man's Worship. Let me read a paragraph from this essay. He's presuming now the theory of evolution, and he's presuming that the universe has a history. And these are assumptions that we made at the turn of the century and continue to make them now here at the end of the century. So Russell writes, all the labor of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. That's a good, happy way to begin the day. I think the theme song for the naturalist position was sung, and I guess I was in graduate school, I think, when this was a popular one on the radio. It was Peggy Lee. Does anybody remember?
Is that all there is?
Is that all there is, huh? And she talks about all of the exciting things in life, and then she, in a whining voice, says, well, if that's all there is, then what's she going to do? Huh? She's going to go on dancing. That's all there is. I'm going to go on dancing. So I suppose if that's all there is, we can go on dancing. Well, that's one alternative, naturalism. One of the problems with that is that the human spirit has a tendency not to be satisfied with the naturalist position or the atheist position. There seems to be within the human breast beating some rhythm of that is in tune with something that lies beyond. One of my favorite examples of this is the Gilgamesh epic. And this story goes back perhaps to the 3rd millennium BC to the ancient nation of Sumer, but is picked up in much later archaeological finds, and Old Testament scholars think that it provides a horizon or background for some of the things that go on in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, such as the creation and the story of Noah and the flood. And according to the Gilgamesh epic, there was a young man named Gilgamesh, and he was the king of Uruk. He eventually became the king of Uruk, but as a young man, he had a good friend named Enkidu. And these two guys had a lot of physical energy, and they were always out looking for trouble. And when I read the Gilgamesh epic, I think of my own son, Paul, who's got a lot of physical energy, and he's always pushing his body to the limit. And he has a friend named Alan, and they come over. He comes over to the house, and they go mountain bike riding. They do anything that's athletic. I had him splitting wood for me one day with a wood splitter. I figured, what the heck? They got muscles and energy. Why can't they work hard? But they had to interrupt their work every once in a while and just fight for a while. You know, and then they kind of go back to work. Well, that's kind of the image I have of Enkidu and Gilgamesh. And it's shortly before Halloween, and they're out now in cow pastures and in farmers' yards, tipping over outhouses and just plain getting into mischief. And on one occasion, the farmer's bull chases them and tromps down Enkidu and kills Enkidu. And so there's Gilgamesh leaning over the body of his dead best friend Enkidu, and really sad, and suddenly aware of his own finitude and his own mortality. And he hadn't quite realized that this could happen. And now Enkidu is dead, and Gilgamesh begins to think, gee, if Enkidu could die, maybe I could die. And so Gilgamesh resolves that he's going to find the secret of immortality. And so the story of the Gilgamesh epic is his search for immortality, and it's a long road, and he goes around interviewing people, finding, anybody know how to beat this death stuff? And he hears about a guy named Udapishtim, and Udapishtim, so it is said, used to be a human being, but now he's ranked with the gods. He has immortality, and maybe if you could find Udapishtim, then you could learn the secret. So Gilgamesh sets out to find this guy, and along the way has many, many adventures, but eventually he ends up finding the address of Utna Pishtim. It shows up on the doorstep, and he knocks on the door, and he says, "Mr. Utna Pishtim, I'd like to know the secret for immortality." And Utna Pishtim says, "You know, I just don't give out those kinds of secrets. You know, I don't know you." And so there's sort of a failure to communicate. Mrs. Utna Pishtim, she kind of likes Gilgamesh, so she intervenes. She says, come on, share the secret. So Utna Pishtim gives in, and he says, here's the secret. He says, there's a plant that grows at the bottom of the sea. And if you eat this plant, you will live forever. But let me warn you, the plant has prickles on it. It's got spurs on it, and when you touch it, it lacerates your skin. There's going to be some bloodshed if you try to eat this plant. I resolve, said Gilgamesh, I'm going to do that. So Gilgamesh gets all the instructions from Utna Pishtim. He goes up on top of a cliff, and he ties rocks around his ankles, and he puts a knife in his mouth, and he flings himself off the cliff, and he goes down into the water. The rocks carry him down to the bottom of the sea, and sure enough, there is the plant that Utna Pishtim had described would be there. And he grabs the plant in his hand, and oh yes, he can feel now the lacerations and the blood flowing. But with his other hand, he takes the knife and he cuts the ropes, and now he returns to the surface and he swims back to the beach. And he's got that plant secure in his hands. But he's exhausted from the ordeal. Now he wants to make the long trek back home to Uruk and use this plant to bring his friend Enkidu back to life. But he needs to get re-energized, and so he decides to take a nap. And he makes a little clearing for himself. He lays the plant down. He goes to sleep. And when he awakens, the plant is gone. And he sees slithering out of the lair a snake which had eaten the plant. And that's the way the story ends. Why does the story end that way? Anybody know? Why would it end that way?
Immortality is evil.
Immortality is evil? No, but you're close. You're close. Who has immortality?
The evil.
No, this is not evil yet.
Oh, okay.
This is not evil. Is there any reason why a person might think a snake is immortal? Right. The snake sheds its skin. If you go in the woods, you can see the dead snake, while the living snake goes on. The snake has the appearance of being immortal. Now, we in America have lost a lot of the symbolism that belongs to the Christian tradition. But there's a very important symbol that in our history, and it looks like this. What is that?
A snake eating its tail.
It's the Christian symbol for immortality. And if you look carefully in European Christian art, you'll see the snake eating its tail. In America, sometimes we find it in the form of wedding rings. The jeweler will make the wedding ring as a snake eating its tail, referring to the till death do us part and love on into eternity. It's the symbol of eternal life. Well, my point here is that even if it appears to us that life comes to an end with death and that Peggy Lee is right, that's all there is, there's something in the human spirit that would like to have more. Andrew Greeley, the sociologist of religion at the University of Chicago, says we are born with two incurable diseases: life, always fatal, and hope, never curable. The critical question is whether hope is a revelation or a deception. So the human race has a tendency to hope for life beyond death. The question is whether that's a frustrated and tragic hope or whether or not there really is something that corresponds to it. So I'd like to look now at some of the ways in which life beyond death has been thought about. And on the outline there, the first one I call astral bodies. Ancient Egypt, so they tell me. I've never made my pilgrimage to Egypt. It's still one of the places I want to go to, but Egyptologists tell me that in the pyramids, which were tombs for the king and the king's court, that the human figures depicted on the frescoes will have a double, a second figure. That, like a shadow, that outlines the first one, and that's called a ka. This could be the background in our civilization for the concept of the astral body, which means star body. A physical form, but without any material substance. The German Egyptologist that went there gave it the affectionate name of der Doppelgänger. Just the second or the double that goes with it. And the ancient Egyptians, and though the first millennium, third millennium BC, first millennium of Egyptian history, thought that the pharaoh had a ka, which would continue to live on after the pharaoh was dead. And the reason that all these toys were buried with the pharaoh is all they have kas as well, and that the pharaoh could go on everlastingly playing with his toys. By the time you get to Moses at the end of the somewhere around the 13th century BC. There, the Egyptians believed that everybody, not just the pharaoh, but everybody has a ka. And that this ka persists after death. And so you can go out to the cemetery and visit your husband or another dead relative, and you can leave a gift at the site of the grave. And then the ka of the dead person will enjoy the ka of the gift. So it was quite frequent to leave a loaf of bread, for example, at a grave site, because the ka of the dead person would enjoy the ka of the loaf of bread. And if you can't afford a loaf of bread, you just draw a picture of a loaf of bread. That seemed to be good enough. concept of the form without the substance has persisted right on down to the present time in New Age spirituality, with the notion of the astral body. And you can go to a New Age guru who will teach you how you can separate your astral body from your physical body while in sleep, and then you can travel from one location to another. And there is some fine connection that looks like sort of an umbilical cord between the two, and they can be severed and reconnected. Some people have claimed to have experienced astral travel spontaneously, but if you find the New Age guru, you can learn how to do it. Probably the most widespread belief in the West is the next one, immortality of the soul. And this belief comes to us courtesy of ancient Greek philosophy and was very much a part of the language and conceptuality of the New Testament as part of the background. I don't see astral bodies in the New Testament, but I do see immortality of the soul. And basically the view here is that you and I are made up of two things, a body and a soul, and the key moves philosophically to make this doctrine work are two First of all, the soul and the body have to be separable so that the soul can live on without the body. And then secondly, the essence of who you and I are has to be associated with the soul and not with the body. If you make those two moves, then you can have a successful doctrine of the immortal soul. One way of dramatizing this is to think of the body, the physical body, as a prison from which the soul wants to get liberated. And certainly in the Plato's tradition, you have this sense that the body has appetites and it has desires, and it's constantly pressing in on our consciousness with, let's go to McDonald's and get a Big Mac. Or I'm tired and I'm grouchy. Or whatever these desires are that the body has that keeps, what, kind of clamoring for the attention of the soul. Well, what's the matter with that? Well, if you're a philosopher, you don't want the body clamoring for attention. You want to free the soul to think thoughts that are eternal in character. Now, 2 + 2 is an eternal thought. 2 + 2 was true before I was born. I had to learn it in school. And after I die, 2 + 2 will continue to be true. Now, suppose I could get my mind to think only eternal thoughts. 2 + 2 would be on the list. Also, truth, beauty, justice. There are a number of qualities that are eternal in character. And so, if in this life I could get my soul to invest itself in these eternal truths, then when my body, so to speak, gets shed, then I could go and I could live in this realm of those beautiful eternal truths. And this was Socrates's desire. And if you may remember, he was condemned to death in the ancient city of Athens. And he was executed. Does anybody remember how he was executed? What was the means of execution? Hemlock. He was given a glass like this, full of poison, right? Go ahead and drink the poison. Well, shortly before Socrates died, some friends came to prison to comfort him in the face of his own death. And Socrates turned it around and says, well, wait a minute, what are you trying to comfort me for? I have had trouble all these years, struggling to do pure philosophy because my body has been contending for my attention. Now I'm going to die and my soul will be liberated from the competition with the body. Don't be sad for me. Rejoice with me at this. I'm going to read to you a passage from the Phaedo, in which Socrates is now trying to give comfort to the people who had come to comfort him. He says, the body and its desires are the only cause of wars and factions and battles. For all wars arise for the sake of gaining money, and we are compelled to gain money for the sake of the body. We are slaves to its service. And so because of all these things, we have no leisure for philosophy. But the worst of all is that if we do get a bit of leisure and turn to philosophy, the body is constantly breaking in upon our studies and disturbing us with noise and confusion. I have tried this line on my wife, Jenny, when she said, you know, Ted, you got to mow the lawn. And I say, I really need leisure for philosophy. And having the lawn break in prevents our beholding the truth. And in fact, we perceive that if we are ever to know anything absolutely, we must be free from the body and must behold the actual realities with the eye of the soul alone. When we are dead, we are likely to possess the wisdom which we desire and claim to be enamored of but not while we are alive. So the doctrine of the immortality of the soul becomes a way of liberating the soul from imprisonment here on earth. A similar view, but developed with a number of more implications, we're going to find in Asia, and that's the doctrine of reincarnation. Who will give me a definition of reincarnation?
Our soul is born again.
Our soul is born again. Well, how does that differ from evangelical Christianity?
You come back as physical bodies or animals depending on our life here.
That's right. We come back. Carn means flesh. To incarnate means to enter the flesh. To reincarnate means to do it again. So I can die, and then my disembodied soul will become reincarnated, and I will go through the PTA one more time. Perhaps you've seen the Saivite, which is a Hindu symbol. You've got the dancing Shiva in the middle, and then you've got this circle with these little flames that go around the outside. Important religious symbol in Hinduism. Each one of these flames is an incarnation, and the whole circle is called the Wheel of Rebirth. I die, my soul is reincarnated. I live my life, I die, my soul is reincarnated. And I suppose if you're a Western materialist, you'd say, hey, that's good news. Get to come back. But if you're an Asian mystic, that's not good news. Why? Because the body is where the suffering is. The first of Buddhism's Four Noble Truths is that all of life is suffering. Now, if that's axiomatic, that all of life is suffering, then salvation is going to be viewed as something of getting away from the physical life. And so salvation, if you're a Hindu, is to get off the Wheel of Rebirth. That is to say, to die and never be reborn. It's called moksha or mukti in Sanskrit. Well, what does it mean then to stop being reincarnated? Well, Sigmund Freud gave it some vocabulary. He called it the oceanic experience. If you can imagine yourself as a drop of water being dropped into the ocean and just dissipating, on the one hand, you become united with everything that there is. On the other hand, you cease to be yourself in any distinctive way. I call this absorption into the infinite. I put it right there on the outline. So reincarnation is part of the Hindu-Buddhist doctrine, but it's not the same as salvation. It's really that you want to get away from. Salvation is to die and never be reborn, and the positive side of it is to be at one with everything. I edit the journal Dialogue, and we had a little story in there one time about the Dalai Lama visiting a hot dog vendor. And the hot dog vendor says, well, how can I help you? And the Dalai Lama says, make me one with everything. Now, one of the questions that I find interesting is, what's it like between incarnations? What goes on there? And let me read to you a couple of passages from ancient literature. Both of these happen to come from Buddhist texts. The first one is a Chinese Buddhist sutra. As the time of death approaches, he sees a bright light. And being unaccustomed to it at the time of his death, he is perplexed and confused. He sees all sorts of things such as are seen in dreams because his mind is confused. He sees his future father and mother making love. Isn't that kind of a tender way to think about it? Kind of look through, metaphysically look through from one life to another and see your mother and father making ready for you. Now from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where in this state between one incarnation and another is called the Bardo state. In the Bardo state, wherein all things are like the void and cloudless sky, and the naked, spotless intellect is like unto a transparent vacuum without circumference or center, at this moment, know thou thyself. Now thou art experiencing the radiance of the clear light of pure reality. Know thou thyself. Any of you know enough about our own Western heritage to know where that might have been said?
Socrates,
that's right. Nistheltan, know yourself. Now, if you're an ancient Buddhist, to know yourself is simultaneously to know the whole of reality, but to know the whole of reality without bounds, without circumference or center, and the chief symbol is light. The chief symbol is light. Well, that brings me to the 1970s. In the 1970s, we had a very interesting phenomenon called the life after life phenomenon. Sometimes called OBEs. Originally it was life after life, but everybody likes to provide initials, not just the military. OBEs, out-of-body experiences. And, of course, the key figure here was a guy named Raymond Moody, of those of you might remember, who collected stories from people who were pronounced clinically dead on the operating table in a hospital, but then brought back to life, or stories of people who were just about to die and came back, or stories of people who actually did die, but in the process of dying, told others around them what was going on. Let me read to you a typical, almost paradigmatic Moody story, and it goes like this. I heard the doctors say that I was dead. And that's when I began to feel as though this blackness, which was some kind of enclosure, they're not really words to describe this. Everything was very black, except that way off from me I could see this light. It was a very, very brilliant light, but not too large at first. It grew larger as I came nearer and nearer to it. I was trying to get to that light at the end because I felt that it was Christ, and I was trying to reach that point. It was not a frightening experience. It was more or less a pleasant thing, for immediately being a Christian, I had connected the light with Christ, who said, "I am the light of the world." I said to myself, if this is it, if I am to die, then I know who waits for me there at the end, there in that light. Well, in the wake of Moody's work of collecting hundreds of these anecdotal stories, a number of other ones, other people jumped into the study, and they said that people who had these life-after-life experiences ended up with three characteristics of a change in their life, a transformation in their life. Three things. First, a person who had returned from the dead would have a new sense of values, which, number one, they thought we should live now and not put off things until tomorrow. That's just the opposite of the advice that my mother gave me growing up. She always said, save for a rainy day. But people who've had life-after-life experiences say, live fully for the moment and don't postpone life until the future. Secondly, people who've had these experiences were no longer victims of materialism, no longer obsessed with going to McDonald's and getting the Big Mac or going to the shopping center and buying new wardrobes. They were no longer preoccupied with the physical world. Thirdly, no more fear of death. That, in a sense, having experienced death and coming back from it, it was no longer something that they were afraid of. Now, that's what the literature said. I have had a chance to talk with a number of people who've had life-after-life experiences, and I've asked them, is it true that these are the new values that you live by? And the answer was, yes, but. The answer is yes, these were the new values I lived by shortly after the experience. But after 4 or 5 years or so, I went back to the old way. I now go shopping with a vengeance. Well, one of the things that prompts this discussion this morning is Moody himself, in trying to interpret this, says that these life-after-life experiences look like what the New Testament calls resurrection. Moody does not say it looks like astral body, although to me it looks far more like an astral body than anything else. Moody says it doesn't look like an immortal soul, but it looks like what St. Paul means by resurrection of the body, and I flatly disagree. So what I'd like to do now is turn to what I think is going on in terms of a Christian understanding of resurrection. And keep in mind, we're going to reference two items together, namely what happened to Jesus when he rose from the dead on Easter, and what our Christian faith promises for you and me in the future. The two are the same thing. As St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:20, Jesus Christ is the first fruits of those having fallen asleep. So what is true about Jesus on Easter in an anticipatory way is true for what God promises us in the future. Now, I want to do just a little bit of background for the appearance of Jesus on the scene. What is it? If you are a Jew or a Greek in the time of Jesus, you might be assuming, before you even listen to what Jesus has to say. I mean, if a strange prophet were to come into this room, we would all have certain assumptions about democracy and how Toyotas are driven and what kinds of food we have on the table at Holden Village. We'd have all kinds of assumptions that we would be interpreting Jesus through, and a very important set of assumptions is that which appears in an apocalyptic understanding of the world. The apocalypticists believed in such a thing as resurrection of the dead, and for the apocalypticists, it was a justice issue. My mother taught me when I was a kid that if I would behave and do things right, I would get rewarded. And if I misbehaved and did things wrong, I would get punished. And as a little boy growing up, I thought that was God's will. And of course, if you take a look at the Ten Commandments, and the law of God in the Old Testament, that's just the way it looks, right? Or you take a look at the whole history of the kings in ancient Israel. When they are faithful to the covenant, Israel prospers, and when they violate the covenant, Israel gets clobbered. Nice, simple way to handle life. It didn't work in the couple centuries prior to the time of Jesus. After the time of Alexander the Great and the Greek rulers were ruling the Jewish people, they were oppressive, and those who were most faithful to the God of Israel suffered the most persecution. And those who gave in, who sold out, who almost denied their relationship to the God of Israel in order to look like Greeks, behave like Greeks, and get promotions on the job like Greeks, they got rewarded. And so there's this sense of injustice, tremendous sense of injustice. And in times of persecution, when those most faithful to God would die, and those who would deny their faith would live, tremendous sense of injustice. So in the apocalyptic literature, you get this judgment, and you can see it there in the book of Daniel, that on judgment day, God will raise the dead, and those who were loyal, faithful, and righteous will go to everlasting reward, and those who had surrendered their faith to unrighteousness will go to everlasting damnation. So this is the kind of thing people are talking about before Jesus comes along. Not everybody believes it, but they're talking about it, just like the theory of evolution today. Not everybody believes it, but even if you don't believe it, you can talk about it. So you get these instances, remember, of Jesus, and you got the Sadducees and Pharisees are talking to him. The Sadducees refuse to believe in the resurrection, the Pharisees do, and so they try to get Jesus caught in a dysfunctional middle in one fashion or another. So even if you don't believe something, you can still talk about it. Now that's what's going on the horizon, and there's a sense in which many innocent people die before they get their just reward. God is a God of justice. There must be a resurrection so that God's justice can prevail after death if it doesn't on this side. All right, a second item. Death is the destruction of evil. Let's go back to the Adam and Eve story. Darius Larson's been spending some time in Bible study with that. And let me offer an interpretation that's relevant. You've got two important trees there in the Garden of Eden, and one of them we remember rather clearly, right? It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam and Eve eat the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and they are judged to be sinners, that they get embarrassed before God, and God throws them out of the garden. Get out of here. Go out and live in the wilderness. And God even puts an angel with a fiery sword at the gate so they can't get back in. Now, why does God do that? Low frustration threshold, maybe? I mean, God just kind of flipped out, lost his temper. Is it really just an expression of divine anger? No, it's not. There's a subtle little passage as Adam and Eve are with their tails between their legs, are leaving the garden. God notices that out in the wilderness, the weather's not quite as good as it is in Eden. He says, wait a minute. He says, those fig leaves are withering. He says, let me make you some leather motorcycle clothes to help protect you. And so you get this very tender passage where God sends them out with a new wardrobe. So this is not an expression of divine anger. Why is it that they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden? It has to do with the other tree. The other important tree is the tree of life. And Adam and Eve never ate the fruit off the tree of life. And if they would have, then they would have lived forever. And they would have lived forever in their rebellion against God. They would have lived forever in their state of sinfulness. So God is sending them out of the garden so that they will die. Not just as punishment, but as a way, so to speak, of protecting them and all of creation from the everlasting consequences of their act. There is a way in which death is interpreted positively here and not just negatively. And we sometimes will have a little glimmer of that experience when suffering horribly from an incurable disease and will almost wish death, sweet death, to come and put an end to it. So part of the message of the book of Genesis is that suffering as the consequence of evil will not go on forever, that there will be a finite end to it. Now let me turn to Jesus, his resurrection. The way I read it, Jesus really died. When he's crucified, placed in the tomb, there isn't any astral body that flies back to visit his mother Mary. There isn't any immortal soul
that escapes to study pure philosophy. There is not even the sense that for Jesus, death is a liberation. Death is negative in just about every dimension for Jesus. I think it's very significant to think of the prayer in Gethsemane on the night in which, prior to which, he is going to be tried and crucified. And I think it's Luke describes him as sweating drops of blood. This is not the mood that Socrates had in prison before drinking the hemlock. He begins the prayer by saying, "Let this cup pass from me." I know for you and me in the modern world, that's probably nice metaphor, right? Nice literary technique there, Jesus. But in the time of Jesus, the line, "Let this cup pass from me," would have evoked in anybody hearing that line the image of Socrates and hemlock. There is a parallel here. Socrates drank the hemlock voluntarily. And Jesus is saying, "God, I don't want to do that. I want this cup to pass from me." Jesus' destiny is not something that is welcoming. And so he goes through the Gethsemane prayer and he wrestles with this. And at the end of the prayer, he says, "Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done." Okay? That he's going to have faith in the face of a destiny that is not in itself a welcomed one. Back in 1970, you may remember the musical Jesus Christ Superstar came out. And Andrew Lloyd Webber, I think, was the writer of that. And I love the Gethsemane prayer. It's long in Jesus Christ Superstar, a lot longer than it is in the Bible. Okay. And finally, Jesus gets to the end of the Gethsemane prayer, and he says, "Let's hurry up and get it over with before I change my mind." So what I think that Superstar captured was the sense of wrestling, struggle, but faith, of course, wins out in the form of courage. What we get with Jesus then on Easter is a resurrection from the dead. But it doesn't look like any of these alternatives here. It doesn't even look like a garden variety getting up out of the grave like you wake up from sleep. You know, the chief metaphor in the New Testament for death is sleep. We've got three other resurrections in the New Testament, if you may remember. You've got the widow's son at Nain, city of Nain. Jesus comes walking up to the city. They're having a funeral. And on the funeral bier is this 20-year-old guy and his widowed mother, single mother with only one son, is crying. And Jesus takes a look at this, and you can almost read Jesus' mind. You know, the social security system in the city of Nain isn't very good. Widowed mother, strong kid, who's going to take care of her? Raises him up from the dead, and he goes back to take care of his mom. You got Jairus' daughter. She's 12. And if you may recall, Jesus is busy healing people, and somebody comes up and says, "Jairus' daughter, age 12, is sick. If you come quickly, you can heal her before she dies." Then Jesus gets diverted with a woman with a flow of blood, and he spends time with her. And then eventually more messengers come and they say, "Too late. If you wouldn't have been dilly-dallying here, you could have gotten there. You could have saved her, but now you blew it." Jesus says, "Take me to her anyway." He comes into the room. People are wailing and crying, signifying that she's dead. And he says, probably, I would think with a sense of humor, "She's not dead. She's only sleeping." It's a pun because the word for sleeping and death is the same thing. Wakes her up. And she has to go back to the seventh grade. Then you've got the death of Lazarus in the book of John. And in this case, he's been in the grave for 3 days. And Jesus comes, and again he gets scolded by Lazarus's relatives. If he'd have gotten here on time, he could have done something, and it just shows that Jesus really didn't care enough, or he'd have been there. And Jesus brings Lazarus out of the tomb. Now, I know that that's a very important resurrection scene, because when I was a kid, I went to see Cecil B. DeMille's The Greatest Story Ever Told. And how many have ever seen that movie? I mean, you've got to be old for this, because those were the Cinerama days. Remember the big screen that went halfway around the theater? And the movie was divided into two parts. And at the end of the first part, you have Jesus calling for Lazarus to come out of the tomb. And the music is loud and the drama is high, and Lazarus comes out of the tomb, and then the curtains close and you go out for popcorn. And then you come back after intermission, the curtains open, and then you start over. And then the second half ends with Jesus' resurrection looking like Lazarus's. So Cecil B. DeMille did understand that Lazarus and Jesus had something in common, but failed to understand what's theologically significant here, is that the widow's son at Nain, Jairus' daughter, and Lazarus all have to go back to their ordinary lives. They're all going to die again. The resurrection of Jesus on Easter is radically different. Jesus is not going to die again. Now, with that, I want to turn to 1 Corinthians 15, and I'm becoming time conscious. And I want to look real quickly at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 42 to 44. If you want to read with me, you may, but I'll read it out loud. St. Paul is using the analogy of a seed here. Seeds look dead. Now, I think scientifically we probably know they're not dead, but they look dead. If you're a person in the ancient world, it's dry, right? But you put it in the ground and you water it, and bang, you get a plant that comes up. And plus, we bury bodies in the ground. So St. Paul is using the analogy of the seed. It looks dead, you bury it in the ground, and then it comes back to life again. And Paul says, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. That's verse 50. Nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. So it is sown ordinary. It grows up extraordinary. Now the key verses 42 to 44. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown perishable or corrupt is raised imperishable or incorrupt. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a physical body, or sometimes translated a natural body, and it is raised a spiritual body. Now, what I find interesting are the words in that last verse for a natural body and a spiritual body. The natural body is a soma, I don't know if that's reasonably well spelled or not, is a soma psychikon. Soma is the Greek word for body, and psyche is the word for soul, comes into English in words like psychology, right? Or psyche. So if this was literally a natural body, Yusuf would have used the Greek word for natural here, physis. But he did. This is the body-soul combination that if you were back in the time of Socrates, you would have been working with. And it is this body-soul combination, like a seed that is dead. I think he's flatly rejecting that view of the immortality of the soul by using that particular phrase. What is raised? A soma pneumaticon. A spiritual body. Now, what in the world is a spiritual body? Well, at least to my reading, there isn't any precedent for this. There isn't any school of thought running around with spiritual bodies that St. Paul is just reiterating. So here's what I think Paul is rejecting, and here's what I think Paul is affirming. I think Paul is thinking this out while he's writing it. It must be an extrovert, because extroverts don't think things out and then write them down. They think them out while they're writing them down. So Paul is ruling out total annihilation. I think he's opposed to naturalism. He would not agree with Peggy Lee that that's all there is. I think he's ruling out immortality of the soul. There's no suggestion here that somehow or other we can peel away a imprisoning body and let the soul fly off. He's rejecting resuscitation of a corpse. In other words, it's not going to look like the widow's son at Nain, Jairus' daughter, or Lazarus. I don't think it's absorption into the infinite either, if, the Dalai Lama or Hindu points of view. What's he affirming? I think in modern language, I think he's affirming the resurrection of us as persons. I think he's affirming the resurrection of us in terms of individuals, but at the same time in unity with God. Individual, yes, but clearly in unity with God. And I think most importantly, and here we have to rely upon other passages than those that I've read, that our resurrection is a bond with Christ. It is in unity with Christ. It is a sharing in the resurrection of Christ. Finally, I want to make one more point. And that is that the resurrection of the dead for the New Testament is inextricably linked to the vision of God's new creation, to the vision of the transformation of this world in its entirety, in its totality. It is part of the transformation. What this rejects is the idea that somehow or other we die and then we kind of run off to some parallel reality such as heaven and kind of sit there while the rest of the world sort of goes on its merry business. Now, I think heaven is going to refer to the transformation of the whole of what it is that God has made or is in the process of making, and resurrection is a resurrection into that transformed reality, so that even though on the one hand the description of the spiritual body applies to us individually, it is inextricably a part of God's saving work for the whole of creation and not separate from it. What then do we do about these other points of view? I want to at least allow for certain integrity to some of these points of view, suggesting that at least in rough form, they probably come out of some human experiences that are authentic. Certainly after talking with people who have life after life experiences, I want to say, gee, something's going on here. And I'll bet you that life after life experiences in the 1970s look a little bit like what somebody experienced back in the time of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, for them to come up with roughly similar descriptions. So I want to allow for some integrity to that and say, well, the naturalist might be right, but maybe not completely right. There might be something going on here. But that doesn't have anything to do with what the Christian promises. The Christian promise is that as Jesus rose from the dead on Easter, so also will all of creation be transformed. That's an audacious Christian claim. But I think that's the horse that we're betting on. So let me end my opening remarks there and see what lines of further conversation you all might want to be following. Yes?
Is it my understanding that under the explanation that you pose with, that you would have no sense of consciousness until the resurrection of the dead?
When I was a seminarian, Dr. Ludwig was my eschatology professor, and this question came up, and he said that for you and me, going into the grave now is like going to sleep and being totally unconscious and unaware of the passage of time, so that when God's business with the whole of creation is complete, and you and I are raised and we return to consciousness, that presto, it may appear to us like a moment, whereas perhaps to the rest of reality there was a long passage of time. I guess I don't know of a better way to conceive of it, even though there might be a better way. Note what's going on there. It's the Christian view, I mean the New Testament view, but perhaps tinted a little bit with the naturalist point of view. That the Christian view, I shouldn't call it the Christian view because we've got lots of things going on in Christianity, but I think that this Pauline view that I've been articulating has almost reaches out and tries to get naturalism, tries to get Peggy Lee as an ally. For that part of it. If somebody has a better way of conceiving that, I'm going to listen to it. But in the meantime, I guess that's just what I'm going to think. Yes?
What about in the Creed, when it says, and he descended into hell?
Right.
How does that fit in?
Well, let me answer a question you didn't ask, and then get back to the one that you did. Don't the creeds talk about the resurrection of the body? They don't talk about immortality of the soul. And there are some versions of the creeds, and I don't know if Cynthia Moldovita is here, she can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But there are some versions of the ancient creeds which it actually says resurrection of the flesh. Mm-hmm. You know, sarks, that stuff. Now, with regard to descent into hell, that comes from, I think, 1 Peter. And there are two ways of thinking about that. On the one hand, there's just the drama of Jesus descending to the realm of the dead. And you could do that in the kind of Hebrew way of thinking of Sheol, as the shadowy existence below the ground which sort of goes nowhere. We are aware of our dead ancestors being underground, and we remember them, so that's the shadowy existence, but there really is a life or in any significant way there. And so that might be reflected. But then you can get a much more active version of it. Hell looks like a parallel reality in which the dead are an audience for Jesus to preach the word of salvation in a way that parallels the way he had handled it for the living. Now, a question, and maybe this is the one that's on your mind, is, well, metaphysically, where does that put hell? Does that make hell another place that's parallel to where we are here on earth right now? And I just don't know how to answer that. The passage is quick and dirty, so to speak, in the New Testament. It doesn't really sit down and try to explain how all of that stuff fits together. So I can't give you a good answer. Would you like to continue?
Well, it made it into the creed, and I've always puzzled over that. What in the world are they talking about?
Well, I would say theologically. Theologically, it's important because it shows that the scope of God's redeeming grace is not limited. It is not limited even by death. It is not even limited by an irretrievable past. There is no irretrievable past when it comes to God's saving work. Yes, ma'am.
It doesn't say descended into hell in the
Nicene Creed. A little more loudly, please.
It doesn't say descended into hell in the Nicene Creed. As I recall.
Yeah.
Why was it left out of that one, or which one came first? I don't remember anymore.
The Apostles' Creed in its original form came first. The Nicene Creed was the product of an ELCA National Assembly, where you had competing parties who were debating and legislating. The Apostles' Creed was more or less spontaneous and developed and finally was recognized. If you're thinking about the debate between the wordings, hell versus realm of the dead, that's a non-issue because you don't have a strongly developed doctrine of hell in the New Testament. You got some different words. And if I recall correctly, in 1 Peter, it's Tartarus is the word that's used there. And Tartarus in the Greek language refers to an island in which the unjust people go after death. That's back in Plato's essay called The Gorgias. And that's reflected there. So you could translate that realm of the dead, or you could translate it hell. It doesn't matter too much, because theologically what's important is that there's no realm in creation, no matter how evil, that is beyond the scope of God's word. Anything else?
Another question.
Yeah. May I take her first and then come back to you, please?
Yeah. I'd just like to hear what you had to say on purgatory.
Purgatory.
Yeah, with a question mark.
I like to think a lot about purgatory. I don't like to think a lot about it. I like to think about it because, interestingly enough, it's coming back, not in Roman Catholic circles. Roman Catholics seem to be embarrassed by it. But it's coming back in liberal Protestant circles with people like John Hick and others who are trying to develop a notion of soul making, that the subjective appropriation of our relationship to God is something that grows. You know, we got to keep talking about spiritual growth. Well, if you talk about spiritual growth and you die before you've grown, what's going to happen? Well, you got to do it after death. You know, it's the same logic we had in the Middle Ages. It's coming back now with this generic spirituality that we have in our time. And so purgatory then becomes a way for continuing spiritual growth to get you ready for the everlasting life with God. Purgation, the concept of purgation comes from alchemy, wherein you take heated metals, right, and you purge away all the dross and you pull out the gold. St. Paul uses the alchemical imagery in the New Testament. So you can find the word purgatory there if you're looking for it. Lutherans have a tendency to reject the doctrine of purgatory for a couple of reasons. One is that in the Middle Ages, the emphasis was less on spiritual improvement than it was on all the mechanics of selling indulgences and praying for the dead. And the Lutherans thought, this is a way of treating God's grace in some kind of mechanical, business-like fashion. God's grace doesn't work that way. Calvin rejected purgatory on the grounds it was just plain superstition run amok. Lutherans have a tendency to reject purgatory on another ground, and that is that your and my salvation is not contingent upon our spiritual maturity. We don't have to grow, so to speak, to enjoy God's salvation. God's salvation comes to us immediately, in the twinkling of an eye, while we're still sinners. So that even sinful people can enjoy a very close relationship with God. And so Lutherans have a couple reasons for rejecting purgatory. So I like to bring it back and talk about it in a reasonable way, but finally, I don't see any good theological reason for believing in purgatory myself.
I have a question.
Oh, yes.
It seems like, I don't know how, where the major thinkers that it originated from, but there's sort of this, within Christianity, this critique of the notion of an afterlife, of, you know, the kingdom of God is here, and you know, the notion of an eternal life to distract us from doing God's justice in this earth now. And it seems that that has kind of served as a critique of the whole notion of, well, there's an afterlife. How would you respond to that, and what do you think is at stake in all of this, talking about, you know, life after death, and why is it still important? Because you know, it seems that is
very important criticism that you're raising has a quite specific history. And it comes from Marx and Engels in the middle of the 19th century, who are naturalists on our list. They are materialists, and they went so far as to suggest that religion in general, we got to be very careful now, religion in general is an opiate that, like a drug, makes people passive in the face of economic injustice. As a corollary to that, you could say that belief that life will be better in the next world will allow me to accept sufferings in this world, and whereas in the Middle Ages it applied to a monk, an ascetic monk, who would be willing to submit himself to the total to total obedience to the master. Now, in the 19th century Industrial Revolution, it means the worker will submit himself to total obedience to the boss. Well, skeptics and cynics have sort of picked that up, and they just love to ram that down the throat of religion, right down to the present time, especially in post-World War II Europe. Marxist understanding is taken as de rigueur, is kind of the accepted premise. I think it's wrong on two counts. First of all, Engels was very aware that the Christian belief in life beyond death did just the opposite. It was a criticism of life and gave hope to the oppressed. And I think that if you take a look at the Christian sectarians, who are usually the ones that emphasize Christian resurrection, millennialism, etc., these are the most vigorous critics of the status quo that you're going to find. So I think that history simply has shown that the opiate theory, with specific reference to eschatology, eschatological issues of resurrection, shows it's just the opposite. If you take a look at liberation theology since the late 1960s, beginning with the theology of hope in the mid-1960s, running through the development of liberation theology, it's all got strong eschatology, with the exception of American liberal Protestantism. But if you take a look at Latin American liberation theology and European theology of hope, political theology, and you look at Black American theology, not liberal white Protestant, but Black American theology, it all has strong eschatology, strong belief in life after death, and that they feel that this is what gives the critical leverage that says we don't have to accept life here on earth. Or, to put it another way, is that the Christian vision is that we live in an unjust society, and our task now is to transform society in light of our vision of the just society that we envision. Letty Russell, the feminist theologian at Yale, for example, calls this Advent shock. Once you have a vision of the eschatological kingdom of God, you're unsatisfied with the structures of injustice in the society. James Cone, Black theologian at Union Seminary, same point of view. And so I just think that the constant mouthing of Christian eschatology as being an opiate is a false reading of history. Even though there is some truth to that, I do see the Christian religion and other religions functioning as opiates, but I usually don't see it when eschatology is the topic. When eschatology is the specific current concern, I usually see Christianity as being quite prophetic and not opiate-like.